morning, everyone. We're here today for oral argument. Our case is appeal number 25-1190, United States versus Clifton Robinson. We'll begin with oral argument on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Hobson.
May it please the court. This appeal concerns whether Mr. Robinson will have an opportunity to seek a sentence reduction under the correct legal standard with the benefit of an up-to-date PSR. And happily, both parties in this case agree on many of the issues that bear on that question. Both parties agree that the Sentencing Commission retroactively reduced Mr. Robinson's guidelines range by about 17%. Both parties agree that this made Mr. Robinson eligible for a sentence reduction under 18 U.S.C. 3582C2. The government barely disputes that the district court would have the inherent authority on remand to order a revised PSR. And today, the Bureau of Prisons is giving Mr. Robinson many of the benefits of that PSR. Namely, it's giving him the administrative benefits that would follow from an updated pattern score. For those reasons, the crux of the party's dispute now turns on whether the district court applied the correct legal standard below in denying the motion for a sentence reduction. And the district court did not do so for two reasons. First, the court made the same error on the eligibility issue, Dillon Step 1, as the same court made in McGee. In both that case and in this one, the district court held that a defendant's sentence was not based on the guidelines, is relevant to Dillon Step 1, because the court did not place subjective weight or much subjective weight on the guidelines at the sentencing stage. But that's not the test. The government agrees that's not the test. And while the government wants to read the district court to have said something else, we don't think that the government's reading of the district court's order withstands scrutiny. Here's why. The crux of the district court's reasoning is in the carryover paragraph of its decision between pages 13 and 14 of our revised appendix. That's where the district court gives its bottom line holding for why it's denying a sentence reduction. Before it does that, the district court says three separate times it distances itself from the guidelines. Says it sentenced Mr. Robinson notwithstanding the guidelines range. It repeats similar language, notwithstanding the greater range recommended by the guidelines. And it notes that while it considered the guidelines, it more specifically and directly considered other factors. Having laid that foundation, the district court then says, denies a sentence reduction because, quote, the sentence imposed by the court was not tied to the guidelines. That's a Dillon Step 1 holding. The court is saying that it denied a sentence reduction because Mr. Robinson's sentence was not based on the guidelines, but it was. It's the same mistake made in McGee. This court reversed in McGee, should do the same here. And indeed, it's not possible to read the district court's decision as turning on Dillon Step 2. Under Dillon Step 2, as interpreted by this court in Marion, the Fifth Circuit in Henderson, and following from, frankly, the plain language of the statute, the district court was supposed to weigh the 3553A factors at the time of resentencing. See how they apply prospectively. But here, the district court's order was entirely retrospective. The district court was explaining why it sentenced Mr. Robinson to 78 months back in 2023.
Doesn't Dillon preclude a resentencing, though, expressly?
So I perhaps misspoke by saying resentencing. The statute only authorizes a sentence reduction. The sentence can only go down. It has to be governed by the policies and procedures of the Sentencing Commission, which place a floor at how low a sentence can get. I think here the floor would be 70 months. But the district court is entitled to consider a wide range of information, including post-sentencing conduct. This court's cases have blessed that time and time again, Johnson and Young. The Sentencing Commission itself has recognized that post-sentencing conduct can often be relevant to a sentence reduction proceeding. And here, frankly, I know I'm getting a bit ahead of myself, but we think Mr. Robinson would have strong arguments concerning his post-sentencing conduct.
But he didn't raise any of those, right, before the district court?
Well, he did request an updated, revised pre-sentence report, which would have contained that information. And even if you put that aside, the procedural posture of this case is complicated. Mr. Robinson filed at docket entry 26 of the district court decision what is best characterized as a motion for the appointment of counsel. That's how he characterized his filing later on in a reply brief. But the district court viewed it differently. The district court viewed this two-page letter that didn't make any substantive arguments for sentence reduction as a motion for that reduction. It ordered the government to respond. The government did respond on the merits, making substantive arguments against a sentence reduction. And then in one order, the district court said both, I'm not going to appoint counsel and your motion is denied. Now, I understand that district courts often recharacterize pro se filings for the purpose of managing their own dockets. But as the Supreme Court emphasized in Castro, those recharacterization decisions are sensitive. It's not appropriate to recharacterize a filing when doing so would penalize a pro se litigant. And I think that's what the district court, or what the government's forfeiture argument here amounts to. I agree, Mr. Robinson did not make an argument in his motion for the appointment of new counsel on his post-sentencing conduct. But treating that as a forfeiture of the argument, I think would penalize him for the district court's recharacterization decision in a manner that would be inappropriate.
With regard to your argument regarding the step one of Dillon, what are we to make of the district court's statement that Robinson has correctly calculated the guideline range under Amendment 821? The court concludes he's not entitled to relief. Isn't that the court acknowledging that the amendment did change the sentencing guidelines as Mr. Robinson proposed? And then the court goes on to what it believes to be the 3553A factors?
Well, I think there's a difference between saying there was a retroactive reduction, which I think has always been undisputed here, and saying that makes Mr. Robinson eligible for a reduction. I think everyone agreed in McGee as well, and in Hughes, that a guidelines range had gone down. The question is whether that, original sentence was based on the sentencing guidelines within the meaning of the statute. And here we think, read in full, the best reading of the district court's decision is that the district court thought the legal standard was different than it actually is. The standard is, were the guidelines part of the calculus that led to your sentence? But here the district court seemed to think that, if my sentence wasn't tied to the guidelines, wasn't really based on the guidelines didn't have a lot of subjective weight, then that's not enough for eligibility.
Does the fact that the initial sentence was below the guidelines mean it was not tied to the guidelines? It went below the initial calculation.
So under Hughes, I think the government agrees with us the sentence was based on the guidelines, because under Hughes, that was a Section 11C1C plea. Everyone agreed ex ante what sentence the defendant would receive, but because the guidelines were the starting point for the calculation, part of how you got to that number for the plea, that was enough for the sentence to be based on the guidelines. Here the district court acknowledged that it considered the guidelines, and that's enough for eligibility. I should say, Judge Lee, the other way to get at our conclusion on step one is to see if this decision could be read as a step two decision. Under step two, the district court is supposed to look prospectively at how the sentencing factors would apply going forward. But here, every single sentence of the district court's order is retrospective, looking backward. So I think, whether you ultimately choose to view this decision as a step one decision, finding no eligibility, or a step two decision, failing to evaluate the guidelines factors prospectively, I think either way, you run into a problem. Judge Kohler, I think it sounded like you were going to ask if this was an appealable issue.
I'm more concerned with what's on appeal.
Okay.
The notice of appeal was specific. My understanding of your argument is essentially that the motion for reconsideration subsumed some of these issues that you're talking about. And that certainly is true in a general sense, that a motion to reconsider can. But the motion that was filed specifically disclaimed any challenge to the resentencing, to the sentence reduction. It was simply asking for a reduction in the criminal history points for purposes of BOP.
This is the Mr. Robinson's pro se motion below. I think I know the sentence you have in mind, Your Honor. I just frankly read it differently. He says, I think Mr. Robinson said he respected the decision of the district court. I think construed liberally, that would be like when an argument you know, someone in my position at the podium here begins an answer to a question with the word respectfully. You know, he's showing his respect. He's trying to be polite. I don't think he's waiving an issue for the purpose of appeal. And to the extent there were any jurisdictional timeliness issues here, I think the government has very generously waived them. So I don't think there's any jurisdictional bar to considering the issues that we've presented here. And I'd, as a sort of practical matter, you know, I think they're fairly teed up for this court's resolution. The only other point then that I would make is about the authority to issue a revised pre-sentence report. There are many potential ways you could think about this question. I think we agree with the government that Rule 32 does not expressly authorize those reports, but there's no need to address that question here, because federal courts have the inherent authority to manage their own affairs, to effectively handle their own proceedings, efficiently handle their own proceedings. And that has to include ordering Article 3 employees to produce reports in connection with pending motions, motions within a court's jurisdiction properly presented.
Well, let's say we agree with you that the district court has the authority to request a supplemental PSR, which I think is probably the case. What mandates that they do so?
So we don't need to show that there's any mandate to do so here. I mean, the district court declined to produce a PSR for only one reason, the fact that the court believed it lacked the authority to do so. So, you know, if this court is wary of addressing, you know, whether there's a mandate or not, candidly, I'm not sure there's a mandate. I don't think there is one. But at least in this circumstance, there'd be very good reasons to do so. And the district court didn't even consider those reasons because it believed it lacked the power to issue that relief.
Would you like to reserve the remainder of your time, Mr. Hobson?
I would.
Very good. Now we'll hear oral argument on behalf of the appellee, Mr. Koenig.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Jonathan Koenig. I appear on behalf of the United States this morning. Because Clifton Robinson's federal firearms offense occurred while he was on supervision for armed robbery, his most recent armed robbery, he earned two additional criminal history points, which have now been abolished with retroactive effect by Amendment 821. And counsel is correct that there are many issues as to which we agree, but we disagree with the core question here. The government's position is that the only question you have to address is whether the district judge abused his discretion in denying a reduction. That's at step two of the Dillon framework. I will step out of my outline for a moment and speak briefly about step one. I don't see any confusion on Judge Griesbach's part about the eligibility part of the equation. In addition to the language that Judge Lee read, there is some in the order on the motion to reconsider at docket entry 34, where the judge says, there is no doubt that if Robinson were being sentenced today, he would be entitled to a reduction in the status points used in calculating his criminal history. That's at the bottom of the first page of that order. So I respectfully disagree that there was any confusion about eligibility. McGee, we argue, is distinguishable. That case is one in which the government had to concede error after Hughes, which is a very narrow, somewhat counterintuitive Supreme Court decision having to do with 11C1C pleas and whether the extent to which guidelines are part of the equation there. that's not what we have here. And I think on the language where the judge says the sentence was not tied to the guidelines is another way of saying, I considered the guidelines, but they didn't drive the sentence. What drove the sentence were the 3553A factors. And of course, the court is supposed to consider both, and it's, we think, pretty clear that Judge Griesbach did that in this case. I want to address the question of whether Robinson had an opportunity to give the court reasons for a reduction, because our position is that there cannot have been an abuse of discretion if the movement gave the court no reasons for a reduction. And it is true, docket entry 26 is pretty thin, and it was basically a request for appointment of counsel. But it's not as if the court construed it that way and then ruled against Robinson and moved on. Robinson had an opportunity to develop the argument in docket entry 31, his reply to our opposition. He didn't do so. And again, in his motion to reconsider, another opportunity to give the court reasons where this movement just didn't do that. And I realize he's pro se, but I would submit if you look at what he did file, it's pretty clear he understood this distinction between a reduction and points. So there wasn't an abuse of discretion. There wasn't really a need for the judge to say much more than he did in those circumstances. The Clayton case stands for that proposition. If the movement doesn't give you anything to work with, you don't have to say that much. You can hearken back to your original sentencing remarks, which were just 15 months in the rearview mirror at this point in time. The question of whether the district court could have ordered a PSR or may yet order a PSR, we believe is moot for two reasons. First, Robinson has obtained administratively the reduction in points and the relocation to a lower security facility within BOP that he wanted. And secondly, if we're correct about the lack of an abuse of discretion, there will be no further proceedings and no need for a do-over. And that leaves just a speculative claim that perhaps a revised PSR may be relevant to some future dispute between Robinson and BOP. Which could properly be the subject of a 2241 habeas petition in the right district with exhaustion of remedies and all those things that go along with habeas. Nevertheless, if the court wants to reach the question of whether a district court has authority, inherent authority, or ancillary jurisdiction, how should it analyze that question? You may sense from our brief that the government is somewhat agnostic on this question, and I think that's because we regard it as principally an intra-judiciary issue. You know, whether the district court has authority over the probation department in connection with a 3582 motion. The defense says yes, and the problem with that is it doesn't really do much for him. A revised PSR would not have been helpful to Judge Griesbach in resolving this motion. There were no thorny guideline issues. There were no, because he had not raised them, there were no new arguments about the 3553A factors that would have called on the expertise of the probation department. So again, perhaps he could have ordered a revised PSR. Perhaps that was within his inherent authority, but he certainly wasn't required to do that, and it wasn't legal error for him not to. And in fact, at the very end of the case, the issues were narrowed down to points. And at this juncture, the defendant said he, quote, respected the court's ruling on a reduction, but he wanted his points anyway, quote, to help with his recidivism, meaning I think his recidivism score, his pattern score. So any kind of order at that point in the litigation on the standalone issue of points would have been advisory, we believe. Whether or not the court could have ordered a revised PSR or, you know, earlier addressing the 3582 itself as such. So it was correct for the judge to state at that point in the litigation that he did not have authority to address points. Unless the panel has any further questions, I'll rest on my brief.
It also seems to me, reading the order denying the motion for reconsideration, the judge, it would be construed as a judge kind of saying, look, you know, I've made my decision on sentencing. And so now that sentencing is over, I don't have any authority to revise a PSR just for the sake of revising the PSR unless it's in conjunction with a sentencing. And that strikes me as a fairly accurate statement.
It strikes me that way too, Your Honor. And the reason that I'm being kind of, insistent about limits, I guess, on inherent authority is because it's my understanding that some defendants who are not eligible have come forward and said, I would like a revised PSR. The department's position is very clear that that is not necessarily consistently applied, but its position is clear that that would be an advisory opinion. As far as I'm aware, that hasn't happened a lot in our district. I may have mentioned in the brief, there are some districts that have standing orders allowing this, and it's just our position that that would be advisory.
Thank you, Mr. Koenig.
Thank you very much.
We'll now move to rebuttal argument, Mr. Hobson.
Thank you, Your Honor. There would be two non-advisory uses of a pre-sentencing report on remand. First, there is a live issue about while the government has provided administrative benefits to Mr. Robinson now, it's failed to meet its burden under this court's mootness cases of showing that those burdens will not disappear. Because look, for Mr. Berg, the government represented that his administrative score for BOP purposes will remain at the lowered post-Amendment 821 range. The government has never made that representation for Mr. Robinson, didn't make it in its opposition brief, didn't make it in a motion to dismiss, didn't make it today. And so there remains a possibility that the government will revert, BOP in particular, will revert to a higher score.
But this isn't just an example of a party changing course after litigation where he was moved across country.
Sure. He was moved across country, but there are multiple uses of the PSR score for BOP purposes. It also goes to credits for his early transfer, supervised release. Those decisions haven't been made yet. And it's possible, unless Mr. Robinson receives a revised PSR, that he'll be deprived of those benefits, held to the pre-Amendment 821 sentencing range. So this case is not moot. The PSR issue is not moot for that reason alone. Second, and perhaps more concretely, if this court agrees with us on the 3582C2 issue, a revised pre-sentence report is going to be relevant to on remand. Mr. Robinson is, in my opinion, going to have strong arguments for a sentence reduction. He's going to be able to say, look, the Sentencing Commission reduced my guideline score by about 17%. It did so because it, after an intense empirical study of these status points, determined they weren't particularly predictive of recidivism. And since I've been incarcerated, I've had a clean record. I've had no disciplinary infractions. I've been pursuing educational opportunities. My BOP progress report describes me verbatim as, quote, a role model to younger and less mature inmates. And I think that's a reasonable motion for a sentence reduction that a PSR is going to contribute to. So for that reason, I don't think the request for a PSR would be advisory. It would help Mr. Robinson concretely in two respects. I think my friend for the federal government made on the eligibility issue, he construed the district court's decision to say what drove the sentence, meaning the original sentence, was the 3553A factors. We don't disagree with that at all. We've never challenged the basis for the original sentence. That wouldn't be appropriate here. Our position is simply that hearkening back to the original sentence in the context of this case isn't enough. Under Marion and Henderson makes this quite clear, even when there's a below guidelines sentence, and even when the district court says, well, here are the reasons why I gave a below guidelines sentence, there still needs to be some contemporaneous, forward-looking reasoning for denying a reduction. That's the correct legal standard. The government's never really disputed. Mr. Robinson didn't have a chance to make that argument here, and for those reasons and the other reasons in our brief, we respectfully request this court vacate the decision below. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hobson. Our thanks to you, to Mr. Dickman, and Ms. Henning for your hard work in taking this appointment on behalf of the court. It's greatly appreciated. Thank you as well, Mr. Koenig. The case will be taken under advisement.